Good morning. The first case we have this morning is United States v. Gomez. Are counsel ready? Okay, we will hear first from the appellant.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is James Trishman. It is a pleasure to have my first argument as a civilian in front of this honorable court. Myself, along with Lieutenant Roberts, represent the appellant, Petty Officer Omar Gomez. The military judge committed plain error by permitting MS to testify during sentencing that the appellant was responsible for the death of one of her twins while she was pregnant, and that she was also in constant fear of the life of her second baby.
Now, did he testify that the appellant was responsible, or did she testify or they testify that they had experienced stress as a result of the charges in trial, and then explained how that the ramifications of that stress?
Yes, Your Honor. There were two different victims. SW actually testified that the miscarriage was a result of stemmed from the offenses. The stress from the offenses caused the miscarriage of her baby. It's not as clear with MW, but what is clear is that what she essentially testifies is that the trial caused her stress. She testified the stress from trial led to her miscarriage of one of her twins.
Well, counsel, on page 9 of your brief, you say, quote, both implied that stress from the trial process caused the pregnancy complications. Now you seem to be saying something.
I would say the word imply is not the correct characterization.
Well, where in the record exactly can you tell us this language that you're talking about?
I mean, okay, Your Honor, so Joint Appendix 41, MS, first we look at the question itself. The question is from the trial counsel, and has the stress had any impact on your pregnancy? So the trial counsel is firmly asking her about what's going on.
Stress of what? Stress of offense or stress of trial?
MS, it was the stress from the trial. SW, it was the stress from the offenses.
Okay.
MS replies it did, and it could be for the stress from this case, and I found early on that I was supposed to have twins and one didn't make it. SW, how the crimes affected you. It's hard to see my baby because he was born premature, the whole July thing. July is when the offenses occurred. Do you believe the stress had something to do with it? She said she was diagnosed with equivalent of high blood pressure, which is from stress. So she answered in the affirmative.
Now, there was no objection, and there was no cross-examination. And many of the arguments that you're making now could have been fleshed out if they chose to do cross-examination of those witnesses. And so much of the error that you're complaining about could have been settled below had there been a cross-examination, or certainly had there been an objection.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor, and consistent with that point and this court's precedent, we asserted an ineffective assistance of counsel to highlight how plain and obvious this error was, and it was ineffective for the defense counsel not to object or engage in cross-examination. But and you're correct, Your Honor, because he didn't object, the standard of review is for plain error. To establish plain error, appellant must demonstrate the error was plain and obvious, and that it materially prejudiced his substantial rights. Now here, there was error because both these witnesses' testimony about the death and premature birth of their children is far too removed from his offenses. Under Rule for Court-Martial 1001, evidence must directly relate a result from the accused offense. And as this court stated in Gordon, this is a standard higher than mere relevance. The most serious, and look at the offenses themselves, the most serious offenses regarding MS and SW that appellant was convicted of was touching their breasts and buttocks through their clothing. The death and premature birth of two babies resulting from this sexual contact was too indirect to satisfy the requirements of Rule for Court-Martial 1001 for two reasons. One, he was never charged or convicted of endangering the lives of engaging reckless behavior, endangering the lives of unborn children, or affecting the born child. Most importantly, there was zero evidence, medical evidence, or zero expert testimony linking his misconduct to the claim that distress caused a premature child or distress caused the miscarriage of a child.
Certainly, cross-examination could have cured that.
Again, Your Honor, that's we agree with you and continue to assert ineffectiveness to counsel for defense counsel not raising that or objecting or addressing the cross-examination.
How do we know it wasn't a strategic decision not to not object and to not cross-examine? This is a delicate area for attorneys to get involved in, and they certainly don't know whether or not they're, if they did cross-examine or make an objection to bring it more to the attention of the panel, that it would be even more damaging.
The problem in this case, Your Honor, is that the reason why it's so plain and obvious, in addition to it being so attenuated, is the highly inflammatory nature of what we're talking about here. If it was a strategic decision, it was an ineffective strategic decision, because not only was it so attenuated, but so plain and obvious that we're talking about some of the most sensitive topics as humans we deal with. We're talking about life and birth of the children. We're talking about accused conduct of having effective death on a newborn. I mean, life is precious. Babies' lives are even more precious. Miscarriage is one of the most horrific experiences that maybe a family could experience. But saying it, you kind of cringe. You always, as individuals, we look for answers. Community, we look for answers. Individuals, the individual response to this is you kind of want answers, like who to blame. That is the natural response. So why this is so plain and obvious is because it's the inflammatory nature rises to the level of that type of emotion, a response that generated from the panel.
Is IAC before us? It's not before us. It wasn't granted, was it?
Not for this granted issue, Your Honor.
No.
I just bring that up consistent with Friends in the United States versus Brooks. This court, when we assert plain error, the court often takes into account whether or not we asserted ineffective assistance of counsel to support whether or not the error was plain and obvious.
Counsel, if it was so inflammatory and such a good bludgeon for the government to use, why didn't trial counsel argue that point? Unless you can point to me to something different, all the trial counsel argued was that appellant had caused MS, quote, stress during her pregnancy.
Well, he certainly, that is correct. That is the time he brings it up, Your Honor. But he certainly capitalizes on that testimony. Because he imputes blame on appellant for not apologizing for her pregnancy problems. And those problems are exactly the highly prejudicial issues before us now.
Well, following up on Judge Olson, where's the prejudice? If in fact this bulked very small in the universe of trial counsel's argument, where's prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. So the combined attenuated circumstances in conjunction with the highly prejudicial...
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
The attenuated... Plus
yep.
the highly inflammatory comments. Take that into account with the military...
Judge Olson just pointed out that, in fact, he didn't use the highly inflammatory comments. So you're just talking about the testimony itself.
The testimony itself, yes,
you're
Your Honor.
You're not talking about argument.
That's correct, Your Honor. But then just to... specifically to answer your question, the military judge instructed, it was a panel case, the military judge instructed the panel to specifically consider the testimony of MS and SW and the circumstances of them as victims as aggravation evidence. And the panel is presumed to follow the military judge's instructions, and so he specifically instructs them to consider their testimony.
Can you explain your attenuation argument? What are the different levels between the... that makes it attenuated rather than makes it more direct.
Right, Your Honor. To be clear, we're not saying a witness can't testify about stress. They can testify. It seems the case law is clear. They can testify about stress from the trial process itself, or just stress from the offenses itself. But every time you're talking about something different, it's a step removed. So here we have the offenses itself, which Rule for Court Martial 101. States has to be directly related. Okay, the trial results from the offenses itself. So it's one step removed from the offenses, but it still falls within the realm. From what, now we're talking about what results from stress. Well, in SW's case, what results, she results from stress is high blood pressure. And results from high blood pressure is now is the premature baby. In W's case, we have the stress, and we have her saying the stress, at least implicitly in her case, like for instance, she didn't say that, you know, the appellant killed my child, but she says the stress in the case, I had a miscarriage, and combined with that, I was also stressed out about the life of my second baby.
But how are you drawing that line? How would we as a court draw a line? If we're saying you're conceding that stress both from the offenses and from the process can be considered. If stress causes preeclampsia, which has a negative effect, preeclampsia does, on both the mother and the child, why do we somehow draw a line somewhere in the sand that says stress can cause, potentially, harm to the fetus?
We're talking about something so highly inflammatory are medically involved. Let me back up, Your Honor. To answer your question, expert medical testimony would be required. To expert or medical expert testimony would be required to somehow fill the link between
them. Are you saying it's improper lay testimony about a matter requiring expert testimony?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's one of the reasons why it's so attenuated.
Well, I don't know whether that goes to attenuation or that goes to simply being inadmissible.
Both, Your Honor. Just in the analysis, I go through attenuation.
You contend it's improper lay testimony on a matter requiring expert testimony under 701.
Yes, Your Honor, because the link is completely broke at that point.
Do you think that a doctor could have come in and given that testimony? Taking the link between the stress and the preeclampsia?
Certainly, Your Honor,
Do you think that your client would have been better off with that than with the one-sentence statement by the victim?
I'm not a doctor, Your Honor, but I imagine that they would be able to bring out from the expert that you really can't tell I don't know what her exact medical problems was. It's just hard to answer that question. I mean, if the doctor were to say absolutely 100%, then it wouldn't have been good, but it's kind of speculation of what the doctor would have done. But what's not speculating is that his testimony bridged that gap, which is what I say is attenuated. I mean, it completely broke the causation link of change, his lack of testimony.
So under the plain error standard, isn't that your big problem here in this case?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
In terms of, well, you conceded that point, so maybe I won't answer that. How do we get to a point where there's ambiguity out there? You're the military judge. It may be that we would not do this if we were the military judge. But the military judge now, we're looking at his actions to the plain error lens. You've got precedent of this court that talks about things such as medical impact, effects on family, and so forth, that seems to expand beyond what the rule says. How can we say, and the statements, I recognize your point, that you feel it was clear in terms of the connection between stress and the problems with the pregnancy. But there also could be the argument that in the mind of the military judge there was ambiguity. In light of that, how do we get to plain error?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the reason why this rises to the level of plain error in addition to the attenuation is the inflammatory nature of this type of testimony. When you're talking about, for instance, race, religion, life, death, that inflames the passion of members. You know, just the thought of a miscarriage. Like I said, as individuals, we look for answers. The thought of that makes us cringe. And that happened not once, but twice to appellant in this case, Your Honor.
Now, Counselor, at what point do you make a distinction of when the judge should jump in and do something and when the defense counsel should do something? I mean, the defense counsel knows more about his or her case than the judge does.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, I understand that you also maintain that a side issue, although not granted, is an ineffective assistance claim. I understand that. But that aside, in your mind, where is the line that determines when the judge should jump in and do something and when defense counsel jumps in and does something?
Well, of course, in this case, it certainly would be overlapping. I can see I'm running out of time.
You can respond to the question.
In this case, there's overlapping. We don't believe it's where the defense counsel's job starts, then the military judge's job is to jump in. At some point, and obviously it's part of the difficulty in this, is defining that point, is when should the military judge step in? And we just have to look at those two combination factors together of the testimony, is it directly related to defense? How removed is it? Plus, what is the testimony itself? How inflammatory is it? And in this case, Your Honor, the military judge should have stepped in, at the very least, as a gatekeeper because of the highly inflammatory language and attenuation of this.
But your position is he had a duty to step in here,
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have more time on rebuttal. We'll now hear from the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge and judges of the court. My name is Lieutenant Teresa Oley, and along with Mr. Stephen McCleary, I represent the United States. Admitting this testimony in question of MS&SW is not plain error because the military judge could have, in the wide discretion...
Counsel, would you speak up a little?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The military judge could have, in her wide discretion, properly admit this evidence in aggravation. First, there's no plain error because as the Court of Criminal Appeals below properly found, the relationship between the statements, the complications that the witnesses briefly testified about, and the stress of trial and the stress of the offenses was not so obviously lacking that the military judge had a sua sponte duty to object. Under 1001b4, aggravating circumstances directly relating to the offenses of which the accused was convicted are permissible. Although,
what if a person who is the victim then ultimately has a stroke, saying it was caused by stress which led to high blood pressure which led to a stroke? Is that going to be covered?
Your Honor, in this case, we are looking at plain error, and specifically in this case, the witnesses, the key here was stress, and MS discussed stress in the context of her current state, which was pregnancy. She never drew a direct connection between the pregnancy complication resulting in the death of the twin and actions of the appellant. SW is a little bit less clear, but she just briefly states, I'm stressed, and this is my belief about how stress has impacted me. Certainly, different medical complications, more steps, more passage of time, things such as bringing in an expert to talk about medical impacts could result in a different scenario. But here, the tie was stress. These witnesses said we had stress, and this is how the stress had impacted the context.
How is, particularly SW, how is SW qualified to speak to the medical causes of preeclampsia?
She's not an expert. She's not, Your Honor.
And she's speaking to it.
She was asked by trial counsel, Your Honor, if she believed that stress had to do with the premature birth of her baby. The question was, do you believe? And she stated, I was diagnosed with preeclampsia, stating her belief as to her diagnosis, and which is brought on by stress, which again is her belief as to how the stress impacted
her. Well, her belief is irrelevant. He asked the question, so he laid himself open to it. But what's the relevance of her belief? We're not dealing with her belief. We're dealing with alleged aggravating causes.
Absolutely, Your Honor. If we're looking at 701 and whether this was improper lay witness testimony, under Byrd and the rule, what would have to be shown is that what she stated was rationally based on her own perception and that it was helpful to the finder of fact. And again, in a plain error context, the military judge could have stated, yes, this witness is just talking about their belief. How do they think that they have psychological impact from the process or the actions.
By the way, there's some indication, did the government confess error at the CCA on SW?
We did not, Your Honor. In our brief below, we stated that SW's testimony is possibly beyond the scope of proper aggravation evidence, and that had the defense objected at trial.
You handed it error.
Your Honor, that statement was made in the context of inviting the court to not have to address error at all. We stated the CGCCA need not decide whether the testimony was properly received because the appellant didn't object. So basically that the court
could
just find
plain error. I'm not talking about plain error here. There's some indication that you confessed that the government confessed error with respect to SW below.
That is the statement that we made in our brief, and we do not view it as a concession of error, merely explaining that this could have gone both ways, which is why plain error is the correct way to decide the case.
Thank you.
Lieutenant, where is the point where the military judge is obligated to step in? And if there is such a point in a case like this, sentencing you, what does the judge do? What is the judge supposed to do? If there is a point where he or she has an obligation, assuming they do, what do they do? Do they jump in and say what? You address the defense counsel? You raise the objection? You prevent the witness from testifying? What's supposed to happen?
That is exactly the gray area of why this court has the doctrine of plain error, because there's certainly a question of when is, as this court stated in Burton, an error so plain and obvious in the context of the entire trial, which is what this court looks at, that the accused can state that the military judge needs to be faulted for not taking action without an objection. As Alano stated, the error has to be obvious and clear under current law. It certainly has to be so beyond that there is no question, there is no ambiguity, there is no other choice but the military judge to jump in.
All right, well, then if that's the case, what happens if the judge decides that the defense counsel is sitting there and not objecting? What does the judge do specifically?
If a military...
Like this case, what should, let's say, for instance, that this was going on, and we'll even assume for the moment that the egregiousness of the conduct of the witness has reached the point that appellate defense counsel feels it has reached. What does the judge do specifically in your mind?
In this case, we believe the military judge correctly acted by doing nothing, but the military
judge... I'm saying, let's assume there's a point that he should have stepped in, but once that point comes, what does the judge do? Or what is he supposed to do?
A military judge seeing something that the military judge would simply be derelict in permitting to go on in a modern trial, as said in U.S. v. Thomas, would probably need to call a 39A session and address the situation with counsel outside the presence of the members.
Counsel, how do you respond to the appellant's argument that it was just the inflammatory nature of these statements that pushed it over the plain error threshold?
Your Honor, we view the argument about inflammatory nature as one alleging error under 403. The concern in 403 is that the evidence contemplated is not substantially outweighed, the probative value is not substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And as this court said in United States versus Rust, a military judge also gets wide discretion on 403 issues. This case is not like United States versus Rust at all, as the appellant argued in appellant's brief. Rust was an extremely egregious situation. The evidence in question was a bloody suicide note. The accused there was being tried for dereliction of duty in that essentially he was a doctor. A patient had come into the hospital, spoke to the doctor that was there. The doctor that was there had spoken to Dr. Russ. Dr. Russ had given an instruction. Members had found that to be a dereliction. But after that, that person, the alleged victim of the dereliction, had gone to a different hospital. They couldn't attend her. She went to a third hospital. Her child was born there. Her child died. That person went home. That person's mentally disturbed lover killed her and killed himself and left this highly inflammatory suicide note. That is not this case at all. Instead, this case is like United States versus Ashby, which paints a picture, although that's not a plain error case, of what the military judge's broad discretion is, even when information, as appellant has stated, has to do with life and death. Ashby was a case where a pilot had previously been acquitted in a previous court-martial of many charges, including homicide, negligent homicide, for an accident where the aircraft brought down a cable car system in Italy. And he was being tried on a second trial related to the destruction of a videotape that apparently contained evidence of the accident. And the government brought in three people that were family members of people that had perished in that horrible accident. And the family members came in and testified that the destruction of the tape caused them great anguish and suffering and prevented them from moving on. And in that case, this court found that the military judge acted properly within the wide discretion to permit this evidence, even though it had to do with, obviously, the death of
well,
the family
members. Well, the destruction of the tape caused them great anguish. That's not this case. This case is lay opinion about a medical condition which allegedly caused great anguish, which the ultimate result of which caused great anguish. That's not the same case.
No, Your Honor, every case is different, which is why the military
judge... Yeah, but you've got lay testimony here on a medical condition, which the witnesses aren't competent to testify about.
The lay testimony, Your Honor, again, was the one sentence where SW was asked, do you believe that stress had something to do with the baby's premature birth? And she stated, I was diagnosed with preeclampsia, which is brought on by stress. That is one sentence, and a military judge could have, if the defense had objected to it, a military judge may have analyzed this question and found that it was proper testimony, either because it did not encompass a lay opinion, because it was proper evidence in aggravation and that it discussed the psychological impact of the victim, or because it wasn't even hearsay and that the victim was simply discussing the impact of stress. A military judge could have found these things, which is why plain error is not applicable in this case. The appellant is also unable to show material prejudice because there was an extremely strong government sentencing case, which properly included the evidence presented at trial, and there was a very weak defense case. This case is completely unlike United States versus Hardison, where it was plain error to have included in sentencing information about the member's pre-service drug use when the member had been convicted of drug use. And in that case, that member got a bad conduct discharge, but she had a very good sentencing case, which included no other misconduct, good evaluations, honest admission of the mistake, no aggravation testimony. And this court said it's not evident that the appellant so clearly deserved her bad conduct discharge, such that the evidence of pre-service drug use was irrelevant to the member's decision. Instead, this case is like United States versus Patterson, where the problematic testimony was just a small part of the case, which otherwise called for severe punishment based on the outrageous offenses and the severe victim impact in that case, which is abusing a 5-year-old child.
Counsel, can I just go back to the beginning of your argument? I just need to better understand. Is it the government's position that the testimony here was merely talking about implications, implying that it was stress, and that it was de minimis on one side of the equation, or are you engaging in a full-throated defense of a situation where an accused or a victim says, because of the offense or because of the process, I experienced stress, and that stress resulted in harm to my baby or fetus?
As to MS, Your Honor, the government's position is that MS did, at the maximum, imply some sort of connection between her stress and her pregnancy complications. She kind of gives this rambling answer when asked, did the stress have any impact on your pregnancy? And she says, it did, and I'm also getting help for that. It could be for, and the stress is from this case. And I found out early on that I was supposed to have twins and one didn't make it.
Again, which stress from what? The trial or the original offense?
MS was asked in this instance, has it been a stressful process for you going through a trial?
A trial.
Which this court sanctioned in United States versus Stevens is properly within the realm of 1001b4. So as to MS, at the maximum, this is an implication. An implication is something that's not clear and obvious, and by definition, if it's not clear and obvious, it can't be plain error. As to SW, as we stated, without outright conceding error, in SW, it's a little bit more direct. She states, I was diagnosed with preeclampsia, and this is brought on by stress. But because the military judge could have possibly applied an analysis and found that this passed proper evidence and aggravation.
The military judge could have done 50 things, include not listening. But, you know, we don't know.
Absolutely. And this is, Your Honor, why this is plain error, since there's ambiguity here. The military judge could have gone either way. Plain error does not lie in this situation.
So in SW, then, you're saying it was de minimis, and that's why it wasn't plain error?
For SW's case, the military judge could have, within the military judge's discretion, found that this was proper evidence in aggravation, overcome 403, and also found that this was not improper lay testimony. And because the military judge could have done those things in her discretion, there was no error here that was clear and obvious. Returning to the egregious crimes of the appellant, the most serious crime that the appellant was convicted of was the aggravated sexual assault of HH. HH was in her boyfriend's house. The appellant was there as a social guest, but she didn't talk to him, did not interact with him, and this is in the record of trial starting at 8,532, that line number. Essentially, the victim, HH, went to bed without ever having spoken and interacted with the accused and woke up with the accused on top of her, sexually assaulting her and holding his hand over her mouth. As to MS, MS had testified, this is at Joint Appendix 84, that the appellant was her direct supervisor and that his conduct included stealing her camera to photograph his penis with it and then returning it to her, indecently exposing himself while she was conducting official business aboard the ship, slapping her buttocks as she conducted official business aboard the ship, and then when she reported her pregnancy to him, squeezing her breast and offering to help abort the baby by taking her in a bumpy boat ride or throwing her down the stairs. As to SW, the appellant's misconduct included summoning her to a shipboard office while she was on duty, and then closing the door, pushing her into a file cabinet, and proceeding to kiss and grope her while she tried to get away. Several months later, he offered her a ride home, asked to go to the bathroom inside her residence, and when she allowed him in, pushed her onto the couch, and again proceeded to attempt to take off her clothes, touch her, and grope her as she tried to get away. There are two other persons that the appellant was convicted of abusing. One was SF, another female subordinate to whom he made various comments and was convicted of maltreating. And those comments included whispering.
Counsel, what's the point of all this? Is the point of all this to say that these two bulked very small in all this and therefore there's no prejudice?
Addressing the issue of material prejudice, it's...
I'm asking you, what's the point of rattling all this off?
To demonstrate, Your Honor, that like in U.S. v. Patterson, the appellant was not sentenced more severely because of the testimony given.
Yeah, you're going
witnesses.
To prejudice. You're saying... Right. This bulked small in the universe of things
absolutely.
In which he was convicted.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Moving on to the evidence that is actually presented in the sentencing case, the government brought all five of the victims to testify in sentencing. They testified as to numerous impacts that the conduct had on them. For example, MS also testified as to change career intentions. She testified that the conduct had affected her intimate relationship with her husband and with her family. HH testified very compellingly that she still needed to go to therapy weekly, that she had become more fearful, that she required an escort to go out to her car at night, that she had purchased a gun, that she had purchased a dog that knew how to attack people. In contrast, the defense's sentencing case was relatively weak. The accused made an unsworn statement, which was the key piece of their sentencing evidence, in which he vaguely apologized and called his conduct a misunderstanding. Talked about his family and said his mother didn't raise him like this and stated that he would like to keep serving in the Coast Guard. He didn't present a single witness in mitigation. He didn't present a single affidavit in mitigation. He turned in a service record that showed relatively good performance but no acts of heroism or valor. And he submitted some financial records about his child support obligations, which the members apparently took seriously because while deliberating, they asked two questions to the military judge about financial impacts of different punishments on the accused. Notably, the members who asked 23 questions during the entire case and two on sentencing did not bring up anything about pregnancy, indicating that they were specifically disturbed or interested by this topic. In argument, the government did briefly make one passing comment about pregnancy, but it wasn't clear if the government was discussing the pregnancy that MS had at the time that she was abused, at the time that she, in September 2012, reported her pregnancy to her supervisor, the appellant. And the appellant offered to abort the baby and by throwing her down the stairs, taking her a bumpy boat ride and assaulted her by grabbing her breast and asking if it hurt or whether it was the second pregnancy, which she was discussing.
Counsel, could I ask you to slow down just a little bit? I understand this is a big stage, but I'm having trouble hearing you a little bit. All right?
I am too.
Yes, Your Honor. I will try to slow down and speak up. Most of the government's argument instead focused on three key points. the egregious conduct against HH, the violation of trust between supervisor and subordinates in the military, and the lack of remorse of the appellant. And that one sentence in argument about pregnancy was just the trial counsel trying to discuss the lack of remorse, that the appellant had apologized to his chiefs and asked for his job back, but he hadn't apologized individually to the victims for the negative impacts on their lives. The defense also did not mention pregnancy during their argument or object to that mention in the government's argument. The defense argued that the accused was in fact remorseful, that the reason for his misconduct was that he got caught up in trying to fit in with the crew and be friends with his subordinates, and that his family would be negatively impacted by sex offender registry. Unlike in United States versus Rust, this court should be able to say with certainty that even without the pregnancy-related testimony of MS and SW, this accused would have still gotten the sentence that he received. The maximum punishment available was 120 years and 4 months of confinement. The government, in argument, asked for 20 to 30 years and a dishonorable discharge. The defense asked for no more than 5 years and did not mention punitive discharge. The appellant received 8 years of confinement, reduction in rank to E1, and a dishonorable discharge. While it was not at that time, a dishonorable discharge, if awarded today, would have been mandatory for if he had committed the offense of aggravated assault against HH. Since the appellant cannot show material prejudice to his substantial rights where he was appropriately sentenced for his very egregious crimes, he has completely failed to meet his burden of showing plain error that is materially prejudicial to his substantial rights, and he is not entitled to any relief.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellate have rebuttal?
Your Honor, the government goes to great length cite cases about how during sentencing, victim testimony regarding their stress is okay. And it is. And that's not our position at all today. But our position is going a step further, another step removed from the offense itself. It goes from offense to trial to stress, and then what resulted from there. And on top of that, the highly prejudicial nature of the testimony. Now, Russ is interesting. Russ did involve a life or death matter that the court found was too prejudicial. But even in Russ, the two things they look at was how attenuated was the prejudicial exhibit, in this case the testimony, how far removed was it from the offense, and how prejudicial was the testimony itself.
But in Russ, didn't they find that the disturbed mind of the boyfriend or husband was an intervening act?
Right. So in that case, there was the court mentioned that there was an intervening act. You know, the guy's note itself said, "I'm doing this because of what happened." Right. I mean, he's saying he's going to do it. So I would argue it's even more directly. But the fact there's an intervening cause link in that case. In this case, the problem is there's no medical link whatsoever. It's not that there was a intervening cause, there's just a complete lack of connection because of the lack of the medical evidence.
Is this Mrs. Paul's graph?
It's not just like it, Your Honor, but I certainly appreciate where you're going with
it. Are you saying basically this is Mrs. Paul's graph? You know, the firecrackers went off and the guy fell over and the scales fell over and bang, 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 and about 14 steps down, Mrs. Paul's graph gets hurt.
Your Honor, when we're talking about the attenuated circumstances, that's certainly part of the equation.
Okay.
And once again, for us, it's a two-part equation. It is the attenuated circumstance plus the highly prejudicial nature. For instance, she might say, "I was stressed, and because I had stress, I couldn't concentrate." Well, that's not prejudicial, right? I mean, we're starting to get attenuated again, but it's not rising to the level of inflaming our passions. And we're talking about life, death, race, or religion, something that makes you cringe when you talk about a miscarriage. Government's argument seemed to be based on, hey, look at what he was convicted of, 8 years is fair. But that's not the standard. Standard is what type of effect would have had on the panel. And like Russ, this court said, Russ, we cannot say with any degree of certainty what sentence the panel would have adjudged absent this highly inflammatory testimony. Because this evidence is too attenuated and it's so highly inflammatory and prejudicial, appellant requests this court to set aside the sentence.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted, and we will reconvene at 10:20.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:20.